Texas Legislature. The Value-Based Payment and Quality Improvement Advisory Committee looked at how to treat the health impacts around asthma, food insecurity, and housing. Brian Sasser with the Episcopal Health Foundation says it's an important lens to view the big picture because access to medical care is only about 20% of a person's overall health.
The rest of the 80% that contributes to their health is all outside the doctor's office. It's where you live, where you work, the neighborhood you live in. Do you have access to healthy foods? Can you exercise? Do you have money to pay for all this kind of stuff?
The report was prepared by the Episcopal Health Foundation and the Center for Healthcare Strategies. It outlines how non-medical programs now used in some other states could be supported by Medicaid in Texas. That would include using what's called in lieu of services authority to pay for programs that cover non-medical drivers of health instead of covering only traditional medical care. Sasser says childhood asthma is one of the best examples of how doctors can only do so much.
If you're a child with asthma, Medicaid and other payers will continue to cover and pay for breathing treatments, ER visits, doctor's visits. But what they won't pay for right now is for someone to go to your house, determine what's causing your asthma inside your house, and taking care of it.
According to the study authors, reviews by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show for every dollar invested, projects return anywhere from $5 to $14 in overall savings. Sasser says that would require a twofold shift in Texas.
So if we can just shift a little bit of that mindset and a little bit of the money from only covering medical care and sick care and shift that upstream, it'll improve health and it'll save money.
Another successful non-medical program cited in the report includes food as medicine projects, such as medically tailored meals for people with diabetes and other chronic illnesses. I'm Roz Brown reporting.
This is Steve Gallington of the People's News, which can be heard on Sundays at noon, Mondays at 9 a.m., and Thursdays at 9 a.m. on 90.1 KPFT HD2, Houston's community radio.
You miss your woman, and I miss my man too.
Hey everybody, this is Glenna Bell, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
That sweet beat of clouds below your knees. That's Ray Lynch, and he chimes in each week for So What's Your Story? You've tuned in to hear So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling. And it's found only on Houston's community station, HD1 KPFT. That's right, you found us again, or maybe for the first time. I'm Larry Thompson, tonight's host, and here we celebrate the power of story. We place a spotlight on tellers whose stories take us on voyages through windows of their souls and on fanciful excursions amid worlds of excitement before hopefully returning us safely to the present. And you've tuned your radio or your computer or your tablet or your phone to 90.1 So What's Your Story on KPFT HD1, Houston's community station. Now let's get to the reason you've tuned in tonight, great stories. We're going to keep you in the holiday spirit for just a bit more tonight. And being the end of the year, I want to share a couple of fabulous stories from 2022. But my featured guest tonight has been a friend, a mentor, a cohort, an accomplice, a coach. Now, that's about as far as I could get into the thesaurus there. But she's been all those things for me and so many others. Her superpower skill of finding, researching, and retelling stories is finely crafted. Now, I don't mean to say that she's finished doing it. I mean that it's down to a fine science. For years, she used her wonderful storytelling principles every day as a member of the faculty for the Institute of Texan Cultures in downtown San Antonio. the last few years, I think it's safe to say she's added world traveler to her resume. And I bet she's found more than one story on her travels. I'm very pleased to welcome this evening, for your listening pleasure and mine, my dear, dear friend, and soon to be yours, award-winning storyteller and educator, Mary Grace Kettner. Mary Grace, out in the world, are you? Are you excited to be sharing stories with our listeners tonight?
Larry, I am excited. The pandemic sort of kept us all in. You know, festivals were canceled, schooled in libraries, had erratic schedules. And then I also had a little interlude with cancer, multiple myeloma, which is presently in remission. So I'm really glad to be back to storytelling. My stamina is a little low for spending all day in a school, but this opportunity to tell a couple of my favorite stories over the airwaves is perfect.
Well, I have to tell you that my stamina is it gets tested in front of a schoolroom full of kids, too. So this Zoom has been really good. I guess if you could pick one sort of bright spot from all of this corona stuff, it might be that Zoom has opened storytelling to areas that we may not have seen and heard from.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard any of the folks from Ireland or Europe on any of these Zoom sessions?
Yes, indeed. Our San Antonio Storytellers meets by Zoom, and we've been able to have storyteller guests from all over the world. And in fact, we give an annual workshop, and the year before, it was Richard Martin from Germany.
That's incredible. Now, the listeners here on So What's Your Story, many times we will have storytellers in the crowd, but many times we'll also have people who might want to become storytellers or think maybe I could tell a story. And if one of them asked you, Mary Grace, where do your stories come from? What would you tell them?
Well, most of the stories I tell are folk tales or fairy tales or legends or something like that. And fortunately for me and for you, if you're interested in telling stories, is that some folklorists and writers have done a wonderful job of accumulating collections of stories in books. The Grimms, of course, everybody's heard about, but also Alexander Afanasyev, who collected folk tales in Russia, and Asbjornsen and Moe, who collected in Scandinavian countries and all over the world. In every language group, there's someone, or more likely several someones, who recognize that stories, and especially their stories, the ones they heard all their life, heard as a child, and then from then on, that those stories should be preserved. And a story collection can tell you a lot about the culture they come from. The best,
and there's commonalities too, I suppose. We find common threads,
yes,
even though there are thousands and thousands and thousands of miles apart.
Exactly.
This theme or this trope carries on in all of these story collections, even to stories that come from North and South America as well, I suppose.
Yeah, that's true. There's similar stories all around the world. There's hundreds of versions of Cinderella, and our stories about Jack, like Jack and the Beanstalk, Jack, that lazy but lucky guy, are found in stories of Hans or Ivan or Juan Bobo or Tijon.
Juan Bobo. You know, I don't know a Juan Bobo story, but I just like to say Juan Bobo. I probably do know a Juan Bobo story, but I just like to say Juan Bobo. Nasruddin, I think, am I saying that right? Nasruddin.
Yes.
I think you have a pretty good collection of now, and you'll have to say it right, Nasruddin.
That's fine. I've heard it several different ways. The Hoja of Middle Eastern stories.
The Hoja. Well, we're going to start right off with one of my personal favorites. This is called Trouble at the End, and folks may not have heard this, if they were born in the 2000s, they may not have ever heard this story. But Mary Grace, you're going to share it with us. Tell us Trouble at the Inn.
Yes, it is indeed a classic. And after just saying that I tell folk and fairy tales, I have to say that this one is not a folk tale or a fairy tale, but it does reveal some things about its culture, the culture of its country of origin, which is the good old USA. So it is a story written by a woman named Dina Donahue, and it first appeared in Guidepost magazine in 1966. So, Trouble at the Inn. For years now, whenever Christmas pageants are talked about in a certain little town in the Midwest, someone is sure to mention the name of Wallace Perling. Wally's performance in one annual production of the Nativity play has slipped into the realm of legend. But the old-timers who were there in the audience that night never tire of recalling exactly what happened. Wally was 9 that year and in the second grade, though he should have been in the fourth. Most people in town knew that he had difficulty keeping up. He was big and awkward and slow in movement and mind. Still, Wally was well liked by the other children in his class, all of whom were smaller than he, though the boys had trouble hiding their irritation when Wally would want to play ball with them, or any game for that matter, in which winning was important. They'd find a way to keep him out, but Wally would hang around anyway, not sulking, just hoping. He was a helpful boy, always willing and smiling and the protector, paradoxically, of the underdog. If the older boys chased the younger ones away, it'd be Wally who'd say, "Can't they stay? They're no bother." Now, Wally fancied the idea of being a shepherd in a Christmas pageant, but the play's director, Miss Lombard, she assigned him a more important role, she said. After all, she reasoned, the innkeeper did not have too many lines, and Wally's size would make his refusal of lodging to Joseph more forceful. And so it happened that the usual large audience gathered for the town's yearly extravaganza of cooks and crooks and creches, of beards and crowns and halos and a whole stage full of squeaky voices. No one, on stage or off, was more caught up in the magic of the night than Wallace Perling. They said later that he stood in the wings and watched the performance with such fascination that Miss Lombard had to make sure he didn't wander on stage before his cue. Then the time came when Joseph appeared, slowly, tenderly guiding Mary to the door of the inn. Joseph knocked hard on the wooden door set into the painted backdrop. Wally, the innkeeper, was there, waiting. "What do you want?" Wally said, swinging the door open with a brusque gesture. "We seek lodging." "Seek it elsewhere," Wally spoke vigorously. "The inn is filled." "Sir, we have asked everywhere in vain. We've traveled far and are very weary." "There is no room in this inn for you." Wally looked properly stern. "Please, good innkeeper, this is my wife, Mary. She is heavy with child and needs a place to rest. Surely you must have some small corner for her. She is so tired." Now, for the first time, the innkeeper relaxed his stiff stance and looked down at Mary. With that, there was a long pause, long enough to make the audience a bit tense with embarrassment. "Now, pick up," the prompter whispered. "No," Wally repeated automatically. "Be gone." Joseph sadly placed his arm around Mary, and Mary laid her head upon her husband's shoulder, and the two of them started to move away. The innkeeper did not return inside his inn, however, while he just stood there in the doorway, watching the forlorn couple. His mouth was open, his brow was creased with concern, his eyes filling unmistakably with tears. And suddenly, this Christmas pageant became different from all others. "Don't go, Joseph," Wally called out. Bring Mary back." And Wallace Purling's face grew into a bright smile. You can have my room." Now, some people in town thought that the pageant had been ruined, but there were others, many, many others, who considered it the most Christmas of all Christmas pageants they had ever seen. And that's Trouble at the Inn by Dina Donahue.
Fantastic. A simple story, a big meaning. And you came across this in a guidepost in reading, and found it to touch you. That's incredible. Are there particular audiences you would use that story with, or would that be suitable for any kind of crowd?
You know, I've used that story almost every Christmas. It is one of my favorites, as I said. So I've told it to all ages. I've told it to mixed ages. Everybody seems to just get it.
Wow. Just the whole time you're telling that, I'm thinking back to a Christmas pageant in elementary school, and my job was to in art class, I had to draw the wise men that were going to be cut out of paper and put on the walls. And the problem that no one had recognized at that point in time is I'm colorblind. I can't tell red and green and brown and blue and purple. So these wise men, to me, they looked fantastic, but I think one of them had purple eyes and maybe orange lips, and there was some green blush on one of the faces, and they were life size. I got Mr. Wilson, the janitor, to lay down on the ground, and I chased Priest's body out and decorated them all up, and I kept them all to myself, and nobody knew what they were going to look like, and they plastered them up on the walls, and everyone was aghast except my mother. You know, of course, she's going to think this is the best piece of artwork ever. But I was so proud of these wise men of many colors. It was unique. Anytime the paper fell off the crayons, I was in trouble. Logically, you know that the sky is blue, but if the purple crayon is and there was no paper, it looks blue. Christmas pageants of the past. Now let's leave the Midwest behind, and we'll move down to Texas. Now you and I, one of our most favorite Texas authors and storytellers is William Sidney Porter, and he's got titles like Ransom of Red Chief and The Duplicity of Hargraves and The Gift of the Magi. And our listeners might better recognize him as O. Henry, his pen name, what do they call that in France? A nom de plume.
Nom de plume.
Nom de plume, that's right, O. Henry. Now, was there anything special that attracted you to O. Henry in the beginning?
Well, no, my first attraction probably came in middle or high school when I was assigned to read some O. Henry stories, the ones you mentioned, The Ransom of Red Chief and The Gift of the Magi. But what held my attention was learning that O. Henry spent some time in Texas. He was from North Carolina, but his parents sent him here as a teenager because he had tuberculosis or asthma or some kind of breathing.
It was the thing, right? They called it the consumption or something like that back in those days.
Yes. So South Texas was thought to be helpful, and his parents had a friend there, Lee Hall, who was a Texas Ranger, and he also owned a ranch down near Catula, a sheep ranch. So little William Henry William Sidney Porter, I guess, came here and he worked on that ranch and apparently he got healthy. And then he moved to San Antonio, where as a young man, he edited a little newspaper. And later he moved on to Austin, where he got married and worked in a bank. And that's when he was convicted of some kind of bank fraud.
Dun, 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 dun.
Probably right. Well, and, you know, we apologists, I guess, say that he was a scapegoat. But whatever, he was sent to prison in Ohio. And that's where he wrote some of his better known stories, which were mostly set in places like New York or Philadelphia. But he wrote some 50 stories that are set in Texas. And many of them, like the one I brought for you, took place on a sheep ranch in South Texas.
These the Texas stories are fantastic, and of course, O. Henry has the classic twist at the end of his tales, and you're transported. His writing, if you haven't ever read, I would encourage you to go find some O. Henry. There's online recordings of O. Henry. We're about to hear a fabulous O. Henry right here. But there's nothing quite like his presentation of language and scenery and description of characters. Now, which one are you going to share with us tonight?
Well, I'm going to share with you a story that he calls a Chaparral Christmas gift. And you're right. He does. We do get to hear his amazing vocabulary, his fabulous wordsmithery, and his sense of local color in this story.
Well, let's hear a Chaparral Christmas.
Had you lived anywhere within 50 miles of Loma Alta, you would have heard of her. She possessed a quantity of jet black hair, a pair of frank, deep brown eyes, and a laugh that rippled across the prairie like the sound of a hidden brook. Rosita McMullen. She was the daughter of old man McMullen at the Sundown Sheep Ranch. Well, one day, two suitors, two champions, came riding up to the Sundown Ranch House on red roan steeds. Well, maybe it was a pain and a flea-bitten sorrel, but one who came to woo was Madison Lane, and the other was the Frio Kid. Of course, at that time, they did not call him the Frio Kid, for he had not yet earned the honor of special nomenclature. His name was simply Johnny McRoy. And it must not be supposed that these two were the sum of admirers of the agreeable Rosita. Oh, no. The broncos of a dozen others champed their bits at the long hitch and rack of the Sundown Ranch, and many were the sheep's eyes that were cast in those savannas that did not belong to the flocks of Dan McMullen. It's just that Madison Lane and Johnny McRoy galloped far ahead of the rest. And it was Madison Lane who won the race. That young cattleman from the Nueces country married Rosita on Christmas Eve. Well, the cowmen and the sheepmen laid aside their hereditary differences and joined forces to celebrate the occasion. Sundown Ranch was sonorous with the cracking of jokes and six-shooters, the shine of belt buckles and bright eyes, and the outspoken congratulations of both cattle and sheepmen. All had hung their guns in their belts upon nails in the walls as a concession to good taste. But just when the wedding feast was at its liveliest, there descended upon it Johnny McRoy, bitten by jealousy, like one possessed. "I'll give you a Christmas present," he shouted from the door, his .45 in his hand. Even then, he had some reputation as an offhand shot. His first bullet cut a neat underbit in Mad Lane's right ear. The barrel of his gun moved an inch, and the next shot would have been the bride's had not that sheepman Carson possessed a mind well-oiled and in good repair. He hurled his plate of roast venison and frijoles at McRoy, spoiling his aim, so that the second bullet only shattered the white petals of a Spanish dagger flower draped on the wall 2 feet above Rosita's head. The guests spurned their chairs and jumped for their weapons. Decorum had its limits on the prairie, but it was considered an improper act to shoot the bride and groom at a wedding. Within 6 seconds, there were 20 or so bullets whizzing in McRoy's directions. He backed out the door. "There'll be a next time," he sneered. Carson was the first to reach the door, and from the darkness, McRoy's bullet laid him low. The cattleman swept out upon him, calling for vengeance. For although the slaughter of a sheepman was not always considered a crime, it was a decided misdemeanor in this instance. But McRoy was on his horse and away, shouting back curses and threats as he galloped into the concealing chaparral. And that is how the Frio Kid came into being. McRoy became the bad man of the Frio country. When officers went after him for the shooting of Carson, he killed two of them and entered upon the life of an outlaw. He became a crack shot at either hand. He would turn up in Loma Alta or some other settlement, raise a quarrel at the slightest opportunity, pick off his man, and laugh at the officers of the law. He became so cool, so deadly, so rapid, so inhumanly bloodthirsty that none but faint attempts were ever made to capture him. When he was at last shot and killed by a frightened ovejero, a Mexican sheepman, the Frio Kid had the deaths of 18 men on his head. About half of these were killed in fair duels, well, sort of fair. But the other half were men whom he assassinated from absolute wantonness and cruelty. Many tales are told along the border of his impudent bravado and daring. But perhaps you are thinking that he was one of the breed of desperados who have seasons of generosity and softness, a Robin Hood, a Zorro. No. They say he never had mercy on the object of his anger, never committed a deed of kindness. Yet at this and every other Christmastide, it's well to give each one credit for whatever speck of good he may have possessed. And if the Frio Kid ever felt such a throb of generosity in his heart, it was once at just such a time and season. And this is the way it happened. It was December in the Frio country, and there was a retama tree in full bloom, for the winter had been as warm as springtime. Along that way rode the Frio Kid and his companion Paco. Now, one who's ever been crossed in love should never breathe the scent of the blossoms of the retama tree, for it stirs the memory to a dangerous extent. The kid reined in his Mustang just downwind of the retama and sat in his saddle, thoughtful and grim. The rich, sweet scent touched him somewhere beneath his ice and iron. "I don't know what I've been thinking all these years," he said, "to have forgot all about a Christmas present I got to give. I'm going to ride over tomorrow night and shoot Madison Lane in his own house. Rosita would have been mine if he hadn't cut into the game. I wonder why I happened to overlook it up to now." "Don't talk foolishness," Paco said. "You know you can't get within a mile of Madeleine's house tomorrow night. I seen old man Allen day before yesterday, and he said Matt is going to have Christmas doings at his house. You remember how you shot up the festivities when Matt was married, the threats you made? Don't you suppose he'll keep his eye open for a certain Mr. Kid?" "Well, that settles it then. In front of all his friends, I'm going to go over to Madeleine's Christmas doings and kill him. I ought to have done it a long time ago. Why, just a couple of weeks ago, I dreamed me and Rosita was married instead of her and him, and we was living in a house, and I could see her smiling at me and feel her warm beside me, and oh, hell, Paco, he got her and I'll get him. Yes, sir. On Christmas Eve, he got her, and then's when I'll get him." When night came, the five or six rooms of the ranch house were lit up like a Christmas tree. And in fact, in one room there was a Christmas tree, for the Lanes had a boy of three, and a dozen or more guests were expected from the nearby ranches. About nightfall, Madison Lane called aside four of his hands and said, "Now, boys, keep your eyes open. Walk around the house, watch the road well. All of you know the Frio Kid, as they call him now. And if you see him, open fire on him without asking questions. Rosita will feel safer knowing you're on guard. She's been afraid he'd come in on us every Christmas since we got married." Well, the guests had arrived in buckboards and on horseback, and they were making themselves comfortable inside, enjoying Rosita's excellent supper, and then outside too, on the patio, on the gallery, smoking and chatting. The Christmas tree, of course, delighted the youngsters, and above all were they pleased when Santa Claus himself, in magnificent white beard and furs, appeared and began to distribute the toys. Everyone wondered and speculated about which of the guests had arranged for the jolly old elf, but no one wanted to spoil it by asking in front of the kids. As Rosita visited with her guests on the gallery, one old friend said, "Well, Ms. Lane, I suppose by this Christmas you quit worrying about that fellow McRoy, haven't you?" "Very nearly," Rosita said. "But I'm nervous sometimes. I shall never forget that awful time when he came so near to killing us." "He's the most cold-hearted villain there ever was," the friend replied. "Why, the good citizens all along the border ought to turn out and hunt him down like a wolf. Get rid of him once and for all." "He has committed awful crimes," said Rosita, "but I don't know. I think there is a spot of good somewhere in everybody. He was not always bad, that I know." Then she turned into the hallway between the rooms. Santa Claus, in muffling whiskers and furs, was just coming through. "I heard what you said through the window, Miss Lane," he said. "I was just going down in my pocket for a Christmas present for your husband, but I've left one for you instead. It's in the room over there." "Why, thank you, kind Santa Claus," said Rosita. She hastened to the room, and Santa Claus stepped into the cooler air of the yard. But she found nothing there, only her husband, Madison. "Where's my present that Santa said he left for me here?" she asked. "I haven't seen anything in the way of a present," said her husband, laughing, "unless he could have meant me." And he wrapped his arms around her. Well, the next day, Gabriel Rad, the foreman at the XO outfit, dropped into the post office at Loma Alta. "Well, the Frio Kid's got his dose of lead at last," he remarked to the postmaster. "That's so? How'd it happen?" "One of our herders did it," he said. "Sanchez, a man with one arm. Think of it, the Frio Kid killed by a sheep herder. He'd ridden past the herder's camp last night before midnight, right around midnight, and he looked such a fright that he scared Sanchez half to death. He tuck out his Winchester and let him have it. The kid was all decked out with white Angora skin whiskers and a regular Santa Claus rig from head to foot. Can you beat that? The Frio Kid riding his horse over the chaparral, wearing a Santa outfit." So that was A Chaparral Christmas by the fine writer we call O. Henry.
Fantastic. My favorite line of that story is the plate of roast venison and free holy. And you can just imagine that scene and that boy standing up and tossing that plate of venison and free holies. I just, every time I hear that, that is fantastic. Now, I'm not sure you remember. Well, I'm pretty sure you remember. We connected in the past over O. Henry, but I can remember when that was.
Oh, Larry, I can't remember the year. Maybe
goodness.
15 years ago, but
it
is one of my favorite memories from my years of working at the Institute of Texan Cultures. We had this small photographic exhibit of works by a quirky 1880s photographer named Ian Hall. And his pictures just looked like they ought to be illustrations of O. Henry's stories. And so we kind of paired each photograph with a sentence by O. Henry. And it was a really special exhibit. And the special event for that exhibit was an evening of O. Henry stories by Donna Ingham and ta-da.
And ta-da, Mary Grace Kittner, and ta-da, ta-da, Mr. Larry Thompson, your host here, actually out in the public telling stories. That was such a fine, fine event. I think I actually put on an iron shirt, and I probably dusted off my hat, and probably trimmed a mustache up just to be out there. And I'm thinking you're right. It had to be 15, maybe. I don't even know that. Boy, so many years ago. But these stories like this are timeless. The thing about a story that was written, I don't even know, 100 years ago, that still brings out emotion and still brings out the vision in your mind of the scenery and the chaparral and the retama tree that's blooming. And I really, I've always been, I'm not much on reading myself, as you may recall, but I do make an exception for O. Henry, and that they're just fabulous. You can read them over and over again. I definitely appreciate you sharing that. And folks, listening into us tonight, that voice that you've been hearing with that fine O. Henry story, that is Mary Grace Kettner out of San Antonio. She's been on the board and the president of the San Antonio Storytelling Association more time than you can count. She's been on the board of directors for Tejas, and I believe she even had served on the board for the National Storytelling Network in the past, probably the liaison position, but I might be making that up because, you know, I do tend to make things up. But this is Larry Thompson, and my guest storyteller tonight is Mary Grace Kettner on So What's Your Story? This is our last broadcast for the year right here on HD1 KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston's community station. You can hear us too on 89.5 in Galveston and 91.9 in Huntsville. And don't forget KPFT's free internet on HD2 that meets all your news, arts, and entertainment needs. We're proud to be here and to have closed out yet another year. You know, we've been doing So What's Your Story since 2008. And here it's not only on Houston's community station, it's also Houston's community show. Our guests are ordinary folks with extraordinary stories to tell, stories like you're hearing tonight from Mary Grace. You tune in to Houston's community station, HD1 90.1 KPFT, because you know you'll hear the finest and the widest variety of programming in Houston. And don't forget, it's folks like you that make all of this possible. Now, Mary Grace, you have one child living, you've got two children living overseas. Is it one? I get it confused.
Sorry, one child. I thought you were going to say grandchildren.
Oh, you've got two. Well, we do want to talk about grandchildren for sure. Now, they're in Germany. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now, when you go to visit them, how do you draw the line between grandma duties and story finding duties? Is it a challenge to separate those two?
Well, I'm afraid my story finding is somewhat limited by my German language skills. But our daughter married a German, and they and their two children live in Regensburg in Bavaria. That's in southern Germany, edging on the Czech Republic and then the Alps too.
Oh, that's a beautiful area there with the mountains and castles and all. It's stepping back in time, I suppose.
It's definitely a fairy tale land. It really is. It's you just see those. One thing I learned was, you know, in some stories, there's a piece where the hero throws a comb behind him and it becomes a forest. And growing up in Texas, I, you know, had these mesquite moths in mind. They don't look like combs at all. And but when you go to Germany and you see those mountain landscapes with the straight, tall pine trees sticking up, then you know what that little metaphor of the comb in the forest means. It starts to make sense.
Well, there you go, folks. A storyteller is never off duty. You just keep that in mind. We talk about ways to tell and ways to learn and ways to find stories, but once you become a storyteller, it's a full-time side gig. You're going to be finding stories everywhere. I'm sure the grandkids do love hearing. Now, what do they call you? Are you grandma? Are you granny? Are you what's your appellation?
They have an Oma and Opa in Germany. So I'm just a plain old grandmother.
There you go. Plain old grandmother. Yeah. Listen to that.
Emmanuel and Teresa are kind of into their double digits now. They're 12 and 14. But when they were smaller, I got to do a storyteller's favorite thing, which is to tell bedtime stories to your grandchildren.
Bedtime stories. Oh, they've got to be a certain age where they're a little bit able to pay attention, but even when they're really, really small, months old, they recognize your voice and the way that you make that story happen for them. You just imagine that sending them off to a sweet night of rest. Oh, my goodness. That's exactly why we're tuning in here tonight, to hear these sorts of tidbits from a fine storyteller like Mary Grace. And we're every Wednesday night of the week. And as I said before, this is our last show for the year. 2022, has 2022 been a pretty good year for you, Mary Grace?
It's been a good year. I sort of finished off that chemo I mentioned and started getting back to normal life.
On the upswing from that. This year has been pretty calm in a lot of ways around here. I don't think we've had much in the way of crises happening, but I'm always encouraged at the end of the year thinking what's in the future, what's about to happen, what's going to break as we turn over to 2023. And of course, we'll be bringing you So What's Your Story all through 2023 as well. You can catch us there. Now, one of the reasons that we can do that is because we have a fine sponsor, as well as all our listener sponsors. We have a fine sponsor in the Houston Storytellers Guild. Now, this is a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet virtually the fourth Tuesday of every month, about 7 o'clock, I think. And, you know, I always say they meet virtually, and I think sometimes people think that they're imaginary meetings, but they're not. They're not imaginary. They're actually happening. It's just on the internet, so it's a virtual meeting. But you can find out more at the Guild's website. That's www.HoustonStorytellers.org, and they'll have all the links coming up there. Also on that same website, you can find the past recordings of So What's Your Story ever since 2008, and they're listed on the menu underneath radio program. And don't forget, our friends at the Moth at Warehouse Live are back in full swing. I believe they still are hanging out on the second Tuesday of the month. They have astonishing stories, and you can really get to know Houston storytelling community with them as well. Another way to crank up your storytelling skills is to join up with Tejas Storytelling Association up there in Denton. We always look forward to their festival in March. And of course, the National Storytelling Network still around, and they're putting out a fabulous newsletter these days, I believe called The Beast, something like that. It's an Great amazing a compilation of stories and artwork put out.
I have a story in the December issue.
There you go. So, and you can find that on NSN's National Storytelling Network's website. Now, we're going to replay a story from earlier in the year. And Mary Grace, I think you know Brooke Pilafont. She's one of our storytellers. And I had her on back in February or March, I think it was. And she told some really amazing stories. And I wanted to bring one back out to the folks. She shared a compilation of things she called Stories from the Iron Hotel. And that story reminded us that even in the darkest times, you can still find a little bit of a ray of hope. And I think that fits into a year ending and all the cold weather and gives us some hope for 2023 to be bright and shiny.
I can. And just like all of our stories, some are full of laughter and love, and others are wrought with obstacles and trauma. And so in each of our classes that we've done, I have felt very honored that many of the participants trusted me enough to share some of their most vulnerable memories. And as they took a risk in opening up, their pain began to heal, and you could see a visible shift in their entire demeanor. In several instances, the correctional counselors shared with me that through telling one of their stories in my class, they were able to begin the healing process and finally talk about instances that affected their lives. And each class that we do has a theme. It could be writing about your first job or telling about your favorite childhood toy. But in this class, I challenged students to write on the theme of darkness in whatever capacity it resonated with them. And here's one of their stories. Darkness is when you are homeless and alone in this world, even though your family lives less than 20 miles from where you call home, which in reality is a tent with no electricity or utilities that normal people have, begging for food or money to survive because your family disowns you as a son or a brother. Then depression kicks in, and the drugs become a part of life to numb the pain of darkness, pumping the poison called meth into my veins more and more every day, until all I think about is where and how am I going to get my next fix and my next needle, doing more and more each time, not caring about my health and well-being anymore. And before you know it, you look in the mirror one day and don't even recognize yourself because you're 60 pounds underweight. Nothing but skin and bone, literally. And then telling yourself it's almost over. Just a few more days and life will be over and the pain will end with it. At that point, somehow you end up in jail, looking at some time in prison. And you realize that this isn't where you want to be, but you're here for a reason. There is a plan for you, and it's not time to go home to God. So this is where my story ends for now. Hopefully not forever, as I hope there is a part two. I hope there is a point where I find the light of life rather than the darkness of the world. But at this point, only time will tell. Darkness has been a part of my life for a very long time. But I stay optimistic that one day I will have so much light in my life, I will forget the darkness. So as Rough Draft began to expand, we also began to include poetry classes. And here is a reflective poem written by an inmate. It's titled, Me, Myself. I ask myself this question: why is my poetry so dark? I answer my reflection: because it comes from your heart. This cannot be, I say to myself. Perhaps I should provide a spark. Fire and gasoline, I reply. You'll blow us both apart. Is there nothing else, I ask me. Do I have no joy? You once did, comes my response. It died when you were a boy. How did this happen? I demand myself. Is there no other way? Search yourself, me replies I. In darkness we must stay. I surely think not, I say to me. Be gone from my sight. For without you to drag me down, I will go search out the light. Many of their stories and poems are of pain, suffering, abandonment, and isolation. And these pieces are powerful for healing, but not always the easiest for others to hear. They give a voice to a truth often buried deep within someone's life. And when expressed, the trauma they hold within the mind and the body can begin its release.
Now that is a pretty amazing tale. Not much we need to add to that. Mary Grace, thanks so much for being here with us. I hope you had some fun telling stories. That is definitely, we certainly enjoy listening to them. Any parting words for 2022, or do you have resolutions? Are you a resolution maker for 2023?
Sorry. The times I've been a resolution maker, I haven't really been a resolution keeper. So I'm pretty lax about it.
That's I don't think you're alone in that. I think a lot of people are that same way. What is it, Jim? Gym memberships go way up at the beginning of the year and then trail off. And there's probably a downturn in tortilla and frijole sales and venison sales in the first part of the month. And then they're going to ramp back up. At least they ramp up here at our house. That's for sure. The year is closing out for us. And myself, I'd love to thank Hank and Eric and Mary, the other hosts from So What's Your Story. We know that you guys tune in and you may be driving down the interstate. You may be sitting at your house. You may be relaxing out back. And we do the very best job we can to bring you the very best stories from Texas and beyond. The year end is so much more than simply flipping the page on a calendar. A new year brings a freshness to the weather, to our lives, and brings thoughts of new beginnings. If you do make resolutions, this is the time to figure out that vacation plan for next year. Maybe you're going to retire in this year coming up. It's a time to recharge. For myself and my wife, we've had a new beginning with another little tiny foster baby. And at the same time, we had to say goodbye to a couple of loved ones. That's a mixture of feelings, of situations, and of circumstances that keeps life robust and interesting and makes for great stories. And the music is gonna crank up in the background a little bit, and we're wrapping up our program tonight, and we're wrapping up a year, 2022. So What's Your Story on HD1, Houston's community station, KPFT. Try to make 90.1 a part of every day, whether you're home or you're driving home or you're just chilling at the park. Be sure to join us every Wednesday evening for So What's Your Story. Keep on loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you even into 2023. I'm Larry Thompson, along with the rest of the team. all of the folks at the station that make all this happen. I thank you for listening, and remember, it's never too late to start living happily ever after.
Mississippi, they're dancing past the window, and I'm trying to gauge the distance between their swaying limbs and mine. They're all tied down by the truth of how our lives change as the wind blows, but my roots have turned to wheels, all my blood had turned to wine. I've known lovers like the autumn leaves, too early on the ground, and then there's those across the fingers, while they swore to stick around. Right now I'm feeling empty, like a gas can in my trunk, and all my pistons fire slowly, my engines turn to jump. The dashboard started shaking, still I laid the pedal down, then the whole thing started trembling, my resistance came unwound. Damn things gave out on me when I needed it the most. Too many miles from where I'm bound, too many more to go. Love is like the fast car on the highway, breaking down on you all unaware. Sometimes you have to pull it to the shoulder, gotta slow it down to make a few repairs. Gotta slow it down to make a few repairs. I hear hard rain on the soft top. I smell white rain in the air, and it feels just like you're with me, oh. It's almost like you're there. Then the tow truck pulls behind me as you turn your head to speak, and I'm alone out on the interstate with a quickly fading dream. Station and the driver drives away. My head winds like a spindle, wondering what I'll have to pay. They're inspecting and detecting all my cables, belts, and fans. And I'm left here holding pieces of all my best laid plans. Skinny trees of Mississippi, they are dancing in the wind, and all their swaying limbs releasing all their leaves to grow again. And every waking moment we learn better ways to grow, but then in every moment after we destroy its truth we know. Yeah, love is like a fast car on the highway, breaking down on you all unaware. Sometimes you have to pull it to the shoulder, gotta slow it down to make a few repairs. Gotta slow it down to make a few repairs.